projects with Steve since I've been here. So I'm going to break this talk down into two sections. In the first section, I'm going to talk about quantum state tomography with compressed sensing. So what is quantum state tomography? Well, actually, hold on a sec. Looks like someone's coming in. So what is quantum state tomography? So imagine you have a quantum device. People are interested in quantum computers and quantum devices because they've seen that they can outperform classical computers for some certain tasks. So imagine that you have some quantum device, but you want to certify that your quantum device is running appropriately. So to do that, you have to reconstruct a quantum state, reconstruct the classical description of a quantum state through a process. And one of the ways you can do that is a process called quantum state tomography. So what we're going to do is talk about doing quantum state tomography using techniques from compressed sensing. What is compressed sensing? But compressed sensing is a technique invented by Candeias and Tao for recovering vectors that are close to an original vector using only a few of the elements of the vector. They extend this to matrix completion, where you can reconstruct an unknown matrix, which is close to the original one if you know only a few of the elements of that matrix. They make some interesting assumptions in that case.
What are the assumptions on the rank?
There's an assumption about the rank. That's not exactly what I was talking about, but there's an assumption that the matrix has to be low rank. So what we're going to try to do is extend this to recovering density matrices. So some recent work has shown that if you use Pauli measurements to recover your base or recover your matrix elements, then you can use in the naive sense, you would need d squared measurement settings. If I'm not writing big enough, just let me know. Or d is your dimension equals 2 to the n if you have n qubits. But with compressed sensing, you could potentially use order r d log d measurement settings, where this log d is really only there for stabilizer states and can be ignored in most cases. So in most cases, where r is the rank.
What do you mean it's only there for stabilizer states?
This is like a worst case. In the worst case, you have to have r d log d. Stabilizer states are turns out to be the worst case.
For Pauli
measurements. That's something that was in the original paper that was proved by Steve and David and some other people. So you have RG, log D. Right. So what does this mean? So we're going to turn to unknown state preparation. You have state preparation. So imagine for a second that we're all experimentalists. I know that seems kind of hard to imagine, but imagine it for a second. And we've got some state preparation, which is stable for a time t. Now imagine that you want to make some measurements on this state, and you have some certain measurement setting that's currently on your device for making measurements. But it takes you some extra time to change measurement settings. So we learned this from talking to some of the people at Innsbruck, where they said that it took them about 25 times longer to change measurement settings than it does to actually take measurements. So if you imagine there's some constant, which we'll call C, which is the ratio of time it takes to take measurements, time it takes to switch measurement settings versus the time it takes to take a measurement. Right. So this will allow you to take some certain number of measurements if you're at limited time, certain number of measurements per setting to get a certain amount of precision. So now you have number of measurements per setting. It's going to be where m is the number of measurements you're using. And it could be between rd or d squared.
What's capital N?
This is the number of measurements.
Total number of samples.
Yeah, total number of samples per measurement setting.
No, sorry.
capital N is the total number of...
Right, oh, total number of measurement samples you can take over the entire amount of time.
Right, and data
is per setting. Mm-hmm. Exactly. All right, so we want to ask a question. Is there a practical T and C such that compressed sensing offers an advantage? To the standard method for reconstructing states. That's to say, if we use compressed sensing, right, is there a way that we can construct states with higher fidelity, in some sense, than using the naive method or the traditional method? If we use compressed sensing, right, is there a practical T and C, something that would come up in an experimentalist's lab such that compressed sensing would offer a major advantage? So we're going to ask about that. We're also going to ask about the reconstruction of the state. So imagine now that you have some data that you've taken and you wish to reconstruct your state. You have to give some sort of algorithm for reconstructing the state. So we're also going to test what the best algorithm for doing that is. So let's be a little more explicit here. So you have rho. We're going to call this the true state. This is the state that we're trying to approximate using compressed sensing, using tomography. Now say you have some set of measurements, some set of poly measurements that you're going to be taking. Where X is some state.
No, I think you mean omega is just a set of polys?
Sorry. Right. So omega is a set of polys. Right, of course.
So there's n elements in that set?
Right, omega is a set of polys. Now imagine, this is what I meant to write, you have a map now that takes some unknown, some
so
candidate
you're
state.
To imagine that omega is given to you, it's fixed.
What we do is we choose omega at random. So uniformly at random, we choose our poly measurements.
Is there a reason for choosing them at random?
You have to choose them at random so you avoid like certain bad cases. You don't want to be given a state which is very hard to reconstruct using only some specific set of measurements. So you can choose them at random and avoid that possibility. So imagine X now is a candidate state that we're comparing to the original state. So this is a map now to expectation values for X sigma.
But there's no index I on the left-hand side, so you mean a list?
This is a list,
things?
Yeah.
Okay.
For I equals 1 to M. Right. And now we'll let B be another list, which is the expectation value of each sigma. This is what you've actually measured in your lab. So you imagine we allow some imprecision that we want.
Sorry, this is what you actually measure?
This is what's actually measured.
It's not actually the expectation value of sigma.
Right, exactly. Yeah, close to the expectation value of sigma. Exactly. Yeah. So that's what I was kind of getting at now. For some candidate state, this will be close in some norm to the original data or to the original state.
If X is
a good candidate.
So if X were equal to rho, then the limit of an infinite amount of data that
this norm would be zero. Exactly, yeah. Exactly zero. So this isn't the exact candidate we're going to use for the algorithm to reconstruct. It's just one of them. So I'll talk for a second about the different ones we're going to use. First one is just a simple least squares minimization, which says minimize X such that minimize the 2 norm. But we have to subject that to positivity, the trace constraint. The second we're going to use is one called L1 regularized least squares, which has the...
This is just finding the density operator, which is most consistent
with the data, exactly. But the second one we're going to use is called L1 regularized, which has a property that if it's chosen correctly, it reduces the rank. And since we've assumed that our state that we're trying to reconstruct is low rank, this could provide a method of searching for better examples. So maybe instead of having to search through all states, now we only have to look at low rank ones. So it could potentially run faster. It's called L1 regularized least squares. This is minimized x such that. We'll also notice here is that we're not going to put a constraint on the trace. We're only going to put positivity, and then at the end, we're just going to divide by the trace to get back to trace one. It's a little bit ad hoc, but it works okay.
So then, what's the point of that first term?
Right. So this is the regularization, which basically it has the property of letting you search for only lower rank states in the case that you've chosen your mu correctly. One more we're going to do is called trace minimization, or the trace heuristic. This is what was actually used to prove compressed sensing, which is just a simple trace minimization. Subject to positivity.
Solve that explicitly. The answer is zero.
Right. Well, yeah.
Sorry, I think you're missing some things. Right.
Of course. Right. Of course. We also need to bound this. We're going to make sure that it's close to the original data in the 2 norm, of course.
So I'm confused about something. So can you explain, so there's these free parameters, what I guess are free parameters. So for the L1 regularized case, mm-hmm. there's a parameter mu, mm-hmm. and for the trace heuristic, there's a free parameter epsilon. Mm-hmm. So how are you choosing those parameters, and how does that affect your estimate?
So in the trace heuristic, we're going to assume that this is Gaussian distributed. Well, it will be Gaussian distributed around each mean. So each element will be Gaussian distributed around the mean. It'll cluster near the mean, and then we can use a Chernoff bound to get a large deviation bound here. This one, we're not so sure on actually at the moment. We're working on some different methods for approximating that in the best possible way. But right now, the best estimate we have is not very good. And it doesn't really work, so that's an open problem we're still working on.
Why have you chosen these three?
Sorry? Least squares is fairly, is kind of just you want something fit close to the data. L1 regularized, like I said, it has the property of reducing the rank, so, and then trace heuristic is one was actually used to prove the compressed sensing paper. So when these guys wrote this paper that showed that you could use poly measurements to reconstruct density and matrix using compressed sensing, they used the trace heuristic to reconstruct the state. I'm not sure exactly why they chose that one in particular, but that's why we're going to test it.
So the reason that you can use the trace heuristic is because if you actually ask the question, what is the minimum rank state compatible with some given data, mm-hmm. then to actually solve that problem, that's an NP hard, it turns out. So you can't actually directly ask for the lowest rank state consistent with some data. On the other hand, you can ask for the tightest convex relaxation, and the trace is the tightest convex relaxation of rank minimization.
I see.
So it's in some sense the best approximation that you can get for which we can guarantee that there's an efficient solution. So that's why we choose the trace list.
I see. Well, there was one more, actually, that we're going to use. It's called maximum likelihood. In this one we're using, because it's very often used by experimentalists, works in the following way. It's a little more complicated than the others, but it's basically that you want to give the maximal likelihood that you'll make the same measurements that you did when you took your measurements. It's a little fuzzy, but I'll be a little more specific. So say you have 8 measurements per measurement setting, and you measure plus 8 plus times, just the number of times you measured, plus 1, and a minus is the number of times you measure minus 1. Now we know that the probability that you got plus or minus for some given Pauli is going to be 1 plus or minus of some x. And so then we define the likelihood function for each Pauli as and then the total likelihood function is just the product. And we want to maximize this. So now our problem is to maximize this subject to the same constraints, positivity and trace constraint. Right. So
this is asking which state is most likely given the data that you
have. Exactly. To observe, right, to generate that same data. Exactly. So now, how are we going to answer these questions? Well, we write a MATLAB script, and we use a program called CVX for solving these convex programs. These are all convex programs, with the exception of this one. You just have to change it to a minimize the minus of the likelihood function, and you have the same thing. So we're going to write a MATLAB script.
Why is it important that they're convex?
Well, convex programs, you can say, you can show, can be solved efficiently. So their global minima are the same as their local minima. That allows you to solve them in polynomial time. So we want to use this because they're easy to solve. There's a nice package we use called CVX, which is very easy to write convex programs into MATLAB. So it works really well. Right, so what are we going to do? We're going to write this script that goes over a bunch of different values of T and C to try to find a regime in which compressed sensing may be better, or prove that there is no regime. And what do we expect? Well, we expect that in the large T limit, since compressed sensing does provably reconstruct the state well, that we'll have a good state reconstruction, but that would offer no advantage over the standard method. But we'd assume that in the large C limit, that since it would take so much time to change measurement settings, that compressed sensing might actually be a little bit better. So the question is not, is there a regime in which compressed sensing does good? The question is there a regime that an experimentalist is going to run into to do this? And so that's where our conversations with the block group have really helped. So the answer, after taking lots of data, is a very confident maybe. And so I'll show you some of the stuff that we did and show you where this comes into play. So this is these are the different C's we used. Like I said, C equals, oh man, I get to hold the hockey stick. C equals 25 is about what the block group had. C equals 1 is the low C limit, and C equals 100 is something like a high C limit. We set M all the way from something around O of RD to D squared. And we used N equals 5 qubits because that was really the only thing we could solve efficiently.
Can you explain again what is C?
Mm-hmm. So C is the ratio of how long it takes to switch measurement settings versus how long it takes to take a measurement. So if it takes you 1 unit of time to sample, but then you have to go over to your device and switch around all your parameters and stuff, and that takes, say, 25 units of time or 100 units of time. So that's what C is.
25 is the number that they have in the block.
Right, yeah, and the ion trap, it takes them 25 times longer to change their poly basis than to take a measurement. So, yeah, and this is the strict compressed sensing regime, and this is the standard regime. So what the first thing I'm going to show you is this is what happens in the very large T limit.
Are these averages somehow?
Yeah. So in order to avoid coming up with some bad case, we average these each 60 times. So we generate the data and reconstruct the state for each one of these points 60 times and average them. So this is the fidelity, basically the closeness to the original random state that we created. This is the trace distance. And these are both metrics by which you can measure how good your state construction is. And so you see here we have trace minimization is in the red.
And so fidelity is on top.
Fidelity is on top, and trace distance is on the bottom, exactly. So you can see that once you get to, you're in the compressed sensing regime, it still does just as well as in the naive method. But trace minimization outperforms least squares and max likelihood, especially in the compressed sensing regime. And we can see sort of a small t limit that now we're looking at c equals 25. And you can see now how when you're in a mildly compressed sensing regime here, you can have something like a 95% fidelity, when in the original case you would get something like 80% fidelity. So in the case where you have a fairly small amount of time, this can offer a pretty good increase. What you'll also notice here is that the trace minimization and the max likelihood drastically outperform the least squares. And here's one that might be a little more realistic. This corresponds basically to what the Vlach group has with their amounts of time and their changing it and their constant C. You can see that the trace minimization in the compressed sensing regime will outperform max likelihood, but then in the standard regime, it's within the error bars of max likelihood, although max likelihood performs slightly better, and still least squares is kind of not doing well at all. But you can also see that the actual advantage you get to compressed sensing in this case is really only a few percent. So basically, it depends on which kind of experiment you're going to use, whether what kind of experimental setup you have, whether or not this is actually going to help. It looks like there could be a regime where it does. And this is what happens when you go up to a rank 2 state. It's harder to reconstruct, and trace minimization now does considerably better than max likelihood. Max likelihood is still looking for rank 1 states, essentially, while this is finding appropriate rank 2 states. Right, so does anyone have any questions on this particular topic before I move on?
So, of course. Which one should I choose?
It's going to depend on how much time you have and in what your constant is, how long it takes you to change measurement settings. So we have data for tons and tons of different times and constants. So depending on what that is, I guess you could look at our data and see which one would be more appropriate. I mean, it seems like there's really no disadvantage to using compressed sensing in any case, so you may as well. And the trace minimization generally will outperform the other estimators. So, of course.
So why do you think maximum likelihood does so much poorer when the rank increases?
Like I was saying, I think that what happens here is that it's still looking for rank 1 states as opposed to higher rank states. So as the rank goes up, it has a harder time finding appropriate states. That's my best guess at it. But trace minimization has no problem with that.
Do you think that's an argument in favor of using trace minimization?
And that's what it seems like, yeah.
Yeah. For the first half of the talk. I have one question. I'm wondering, do you know rank a priori, or the rank if you have to?
You're assuming before you begin your state reconstruction, the state is low rank when you start. It's approximately low rank, so it's supported on some like. Something close to a low number of, right, to a low rank state. So you can reconstruct something that looks, you can reconstruct a low rank state which is almost the same as the original state. That's the idea.
Okay. On the other hand, the experiment, they may have, you know, the tiny somehow you made on the other subspaces. So do you have some cutoff to somehow get some Roland thing?
Right. So we, if you're trying to reconstruct actual data from an experiment, we'll see which, right, we'll cut it off at a certain point. So we ignore those which are only slightly, so probably very small eigenvalues.
There's a simple argument for why that's a reasonable thing to do. So imagine you were trying to create a pure state, and let's say that this pure state is subject to some kind of local dephasing noise or depolarizing noise. Right? So you send each qubit through a depolarizing channel. So what does the rank of the new state, right? So this is the state that you're actually preparing now, right? Is this sort of noisy state. So what's the rank of this new state? Well, obviously it's full rank.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, most of its rank is concentrated in a subspace of dimension d to the h of p, where h of p is the binary entropy of a depolarizing channel. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's just compression, right? Schumacher compression. So that means when p is small, when your depolarizing channel has only a small error, but the state has low rank, right? D
but
to the.
No, of course not.
But the point is that. The trace heuristic is going to reconstruct a state which has a rank d to the some small constant, right, where that constant is much less than 1, as long as p is small. Right? So that's low rank relative to a typical state which might have full b. Right? So that's the point, right? So the error that you make in making that approximation is exponentially small. So I admit that you make an error, but by ignoring all of those other states, which, you know, there's asymptotically, there's many, many, many more such states. Mm-hmm. By ignoring all of them, you get a much more concise classical description, first of all, but the amount of error that you incur by doing that is exponentially small. So you basically lose very little by making that approximation.
But I think that somehow using the Schumacher compression, we can focus on the rank one state or the rank one two.
No, it doesn't have to be rank one. Mm-hmm. So that argument's pretty general, actually. Okay, so maybe let's go to the second part.
Okay. So where's my eraser?
There's plenty of boards.
Yeah, that's true. So, I'm going to talk about a couple of problems that come up naturally in physics. One of them being computing the ground state degeneracy of some local Hamiltonian, and computing the density of states of some local Hamiltonian. So these are the two problems. So. Now, first of these, the ground state degeneracy is useful for a number of things in physics. So, say you have a quantum error correcting code, and you want to know the number of code words that you can get into it, and you have to stabilize with the code have low weight, then it's approximated by a local Hamiltonian. So it gives you a local Hamiltonian. Or if you want to count solutions to a problem called quantum k-sat, which is a little bit less natural, but I'll talk about what that is later. The density of states is useful in some semiconductor physics and for computing a lot of thermodynamic properties like internal energy and specific heat and some other things. So we have these two problems. Now, what we're going to do is since these problems seem, as pointed out by Bravi, Moore, and Russell in a paper that we read when preparing for an entirely different project, these things seem very difficult to compute. So we're going to switch from actually trying to compute, giving an algorithm for actually trying to compute something like this, to giving a characterization of how hard they are in general to solve. And what that's been a technique, a tool that's been pretty useful for that lately has been called computational complexity. This is a tool that's been used by computer scientists to characterize the difficulty of solving all sorts of problems, but since quantum computing has sort of come around, it's been more and more used to characterize the difficulty of solving quantum problems as well as the difficulty of solving classical problems. So, to be a little bit more specific about this, we're going to say we have n qubits. And we have some local terms of our Hamiltonian which act on these qubits. So these are qubits. These are Hamiltonian terms. Mm-hmm. Now we ask the following question. Let these terms be projectors, and we say the Hamiltonian is a sum of projectors. Is the ground state energy exactly zero, or is it greater than A? Or if instead of letting them be projectors, we just let them be local Hamiltonian terms.
Sorry, what's A?
A is just some energy that's given. It's just a promise gap that says we're not concerned about what happens between zero and A.
Are there any constraints on how large A is?
As long as it's polynomially bounded away from zero, then you're fine. So as long as this gap, right, so it has to be greater than 1 over poly. So now instead of letting them be projectors, we'll instead just let them be local Hamiltonian terms. And we ask, not is it equal to zero, but is it less than some given A, or we're promised it's not between, or is it greater than some B, when we're promised it's not between A and B. And again, there's a 1 over poly gap between A and B. So these are both fairly natural problems.
Just to make sure I understand. So this is some kind of formalization of the top two problems.
Exactly, exactly.
Sort of in the opposite order, except you seem to be asking, does there exist
right, so that's what I was getting to.
Okay.
We're asking, these are sort of decision questions. Does there exist a lambda zero with the following property? Or, but you could also change to counting questions. How many lambda zeros are there? And so what you can probably see is that by doing this density of states or ground state degeneracy calculation, what we're doing is actually just generalizing these decision problems to a counting equivalent. So let's talk a little bit about how this sort of corresponds to classical complexity, sort of why it makes this so hard. In classical complexity, you have the class which everyone knows, P, which is things that are computable in polynomial time. The other class that everyone knows, NP, which is things that are computable and verifiable in polynomial time, but they could take as long as you want to actually answer them. Similarly, you go to the quantum world, and you have BQP, class of things that are efficiently computable on a quantum computer, and QMA, class of things which are efficiently verifiable on a quantum computer, but you can take as much time as you want to solve them. You may have heard of the big open question about whether these two are equal. It's still open. So now you can generalize this to counting problems in a class that's called sharp P, which can't strictly be put in this hierarchy, but in some senses it must be harder than NP. Because sharp P is the problem of counting solutions to these problems. So to solve this, you must at least be able to solve this, but in some stricter and more formal sense, this is actually much more powerful. We'll talk about what that strict sense is in a minute. So what we do is we define this for the quantum case. We call it sharp BQP. And our main result is that for some fairly natural notion of equality, these two classes are actually equal. So that's our main result.
So why should I be surprised?
So since we're asking about quantum questions, you may think that this is actually a harder problem to solve. But it turns out that there is an intuition for why these would actually be the same, which is, oddly enough, kind of counterintuitive at first. So I'll explain. First, I'll show this proof. Right. It makes sense. And then I'll explain a little bit of the intuition as to why that shouldn't be so surprising.
Is there a relation between the lower circles, like QMA and MP?
Yeah, so it's a little weird, but basically, it looks something like...
Throw it on a new board.
Yeah, that's a good idea. It looks something like... Here's P, and BQP strictly contains P. But there's some problems in BQP that are outside of NP.
Okay.
So anything that can be done on a quantum computer efficiently can clearly be done on a classical computer efficiently. And so for the same reason, QMA surrounds all of these. So efficiently verifiable on a quantum computer is also, or efficiently verifiable on a classical computer is also efficiently verifiable on a quantum computer. But some of the things you can do on a quantum computer quickly, you can't necessarily do quickly on a classical computer.
And so our new
class would go outside here and say sharp BQP equals sharp P. Right. So the reason that these questions are actually so hard to answer is that they're complete for this class QMA in some certain precise sense, which means that they're as hard as the hardest problems in this class. And so now what we want to do is count the number of solutions to the hardest problems in this class, which is an extremely hard problem. So we'll be a little more precise, and we'll define what QMA actually is. It's a set of all problems such that we want to compute some language. We want to compute the elements of it, then there is some quantum state which will convince you with high probability that you're in a yes instance. Call that a witness. This is a different A than we were talking about before. I want to call it A prime, just to be specific. But if it's not in the language, then there is no such witness which will convince you with high probability. Or again, there's a polynomial gap between A and B. And so basically, what we want to do is consider a space which contains only these witnesses which are accepted with high probability and compute the dimension of that space. It's a little bit vague, and there's a couple of ways we can do that. So now, there's a slight problem with the way QMA is originally defined in that it allows for witnesses which can be extremely close to good witnesses but are still bad. So imagine you have some probability here, or this is a scale of witnesses. So if this is A and B, you've got some witness here.
Sorry, what's the vertical axis? Is what? The
probability of acceptance.
Probability
of acceptance.
Are you assuming you're in a yes instance or a no instance?
Right, this is for a yes instance. Okay. So here we have a good witness. And down here we can have some bad witnesses. But we can also have witnesses which are in this intermediate regime. And those are the bad guys. Because they can convince us with something that's very close to high probability that we're accepting, but are not actually the witnesses we're looking for. So we want to find a way of getting rid of those guys. And so what we do to do that is sort of just promise that we don't have any. It's a little bit kind of like cheating, but it still works. So we define this class as spec QMA, where first you decompose your Hilbert space into a class of accepting witnesses, or into an accepting subspace and a rejecting subspace, and that's a little bit, there's some subtleties here, which I'll talk about in a minute, but just work with that for now. And we say that in a yes instance, for all states in this space, you have a high probability of acceptance. But for all states in this non-accepting space, we have a low probability of acceptance. And again...
Sorry, you used the same S there.
I just forgot to write the top of the perp. But we have the same condition with nominal language. Now we promise there's a polygap between A and B still. Okay, so now we're going to define.
So wait, let me just make sure I understand this. So S, what are S and S prime? Can you just
S and S perp. S is the accepting subspace. And S perp is sort of the rejecting subspace.
And you promise that there are none of these marginally accepting witnesses
exactly.
That occur in between A and B.
Exactly. Okay. I promise that there's no marginally accepting cases like these, which we'll get in the original definition of QMA.
There's none of them in the space?
Right. Right. So we only have a space that's accepted with high probability and a space that's that's rejected with high probability.
What if you have a superposition of the state from...
Yeah, so, there's a question here about, sorry, what were you saying?
No, go ahead.
Right, whether or not this is well-defined, but it turns out that you can, even if you have a superposition, you can't actually fool the verifier because you couldn't, up to the dimension, this is still well-defined. So if you have some other way of partitioning your Hilbert space, such that you try to include a half witness, then the dimension is actually still the same. The dimension of either space. So imagine now that you have some second way, right, where you try to cheat and give us a bad witness in here, then the dimension of these are still the same. And what we're worried about computing is the dimension of that space.
Right.
So I can prove that.
Okay, first of all, it's not actually. I mean, it's always true that they're assuming S and S perp are both. Not empty.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be some witnesses that fall in between.
Sure.
The question is whether you can have these spaces at all. But I don't understand. So, who is doing this decomposition to S and S perp? So what is this business about fooling you by choosing some other?
Well, you have this QMA protocol, right? And Merlin gives you a witness which is bad, but is exponentially close to being accepted with high probability, right? So then Merlin is almost sort of fooling you.
Sorry, what does it mean that's bad? But it's
so you want to say it's not accepted with probability greater than A. It's accepted with probability exponentially close to A, but less than A.
And we can't tell the
difference between those two situations. So we have to be promised that we're never going to be given something like that.
So the promise is that there exists S and S perp, such that the whole Hilbert space is the direct sum of those two.
Right.
And S and S perp, but S is not the set of all witnesses that are greater than A, and S perp is not the space of all witnesses that are less than A.
Right.
Those are not subspaces.
Exactly.
It's not that you're promised that you're not given one of those. It's just that you're promised that there exists this.
Yeah. That's probably the more accurate way to put it. Right.
Okay.
Because a fully general Hilbert space decomposition would also have a third summand.
Right.
Which could contain these marginal bases.
Exactly.
And the promise is that...
there is some decomposition which...
for which that term
which this is true.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going to define sharp DQP now and
right.
show that it's well that this dimension is well defined.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And so, yeah, we're going to define sharp DQP. That's annoying.
Just screw on the next board. You got plenty of boards. There's three more boards after
that. Oh, jeez, so many boards. All right, well, I'll write this right here. Problems of the form, compute, dimension of S, where S is the accepting subspace of a verifier. Does this one move too? No. So that's our sharp DQP question, and as you might wonder, again, can you decompose this into two different decompositions such that the dimension is different? And the answer is no, there's not, for the following reason. It's a proof by contradiction. Just assume that dim S is less than dim R. And then that can tell you that, that dim S plus dim R perp is greater than the total dimension of your Hilbert space, which means that there has to exist some state which is in their intersection. But we've already told you that there's these are both decompositions into accepting and rejecting spaces, and thus there could be nothing in the intersection of these two. And thus this is a well-defined definition.
There can't be a state which is both accepted and rejected.
Exactly. That's exactly what this is saying. The state can't exist. So that's proof by contradiction. Right. So now we're going to talk for a second about what our notion of equality is. Now, in complexity, there's a couple different notions of what equality actually is. In this case,
equality of what?
Of complexity classes. Yeah, so there's a bunch of different notions of equality of problems in complexity classes and in computational complexity. And in this case, the most natural definition is something what's called a weakly parsimonious reduction. Now, a weakly parsimonious reduction is the following. Say you have a function f and a function g, and you want to say that f is reducible to g, and thus you do some operation which transforms the output and another operation which transforms the input. So these are both polytime computable functions, which is to say that all you do is you have f, a problem you want to solve, and you have g, a problem you know how to solve, and so you take your input, and you divide by 2, and you add 7, and you throw it to a solver for g, you get your answer back, and you have to add 5 and divide by 4 or something, and now you have your result again. So really, you're just pre- and post-processing the input to the solver for G. And that's what's called a weakly parsimonious reduction. So we can pre- and post-process. So we're going to have a strategy for proving that goes something along the following. First, we're going to try to amplify away all of the potential bad witnesses. Then we're going to decompose our quantum circuit into a Feynman path integral, and then show that this is approximately equal to some sharp P function, and turn back to our sharp BQP function and show that we've bounded our error so much that we're close to the right answer, and so we actually are given the exact right answer. So we'll be a little more specific with that. Say you have some QMA verifier, and it says QMA AB, where there's a poly gap between A and B. You can amplify that into a QMA which is exponentially close on either side, where P of n is just some polynomial. So basically, you can amplify away the problems that you're going to have, the negative witnesses and that sort of thing.
Sorry, so what that's saying is basically the probability that I get a false, that the answer is really, that the witness is actually correct and I accidentally reject it,
mm-hmm.
or that the witness is...
Is exponentially small.
Bad. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That probability is exponentially small. Okay. So now what we do is we write...
So false positive and false negative are symmetric.
They're symmetric.
They're suppressed by some exponential.
Right, and they're the probability of getting them is symmetric, right? Is it equal? Right. So now what I want to do is have some quantum circuit. And we so we have here our initial state. And we time evolve this according to U, which is our unitary by our quantum or from our verifier. We project onto accepting. All right.
Sorry, I'm confused. So I think, what's that thing in the middle, first of all?
This is a projector. This is basically saying you want to measure that you got a yes or a answer. So you got a zero when you're.
So I think you mean to put the dagger on the other side, right?
Yes, I think you're right.
So you're unevolved.
Yeah. So you're unevolved.
That's conceptually the same.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so maybe could you just label that because it's a little confusing.
Mm-hmm. All right. So now if we compute the trace of this, that's going to be exactly the number of... It's going to be exactly the dimension of your accepting space, where this is a projector onto that accepting space.
So
plus
pi s is the projector. Sorry, pi accept is the projector onto s.
Yeah, I could actually call that pi s. It'd be a little simpler. But you're also going to have, of course, your false positives and your false negatives. So these are the times when you got a bad witness, but you accepted anyway. And these are the times when you got a good witness, but you rejected because you have some error there. Right, so... We know that if we have some unitary, we can decompose that into small products of smaller unitaries. And now we compute matrix element by using Feynman sum. It's going to be some sum of rational numbers if you choose your gate basis correctly. Goes on. So this here is the Feynman decomposition, which is now a sum of rational numbers if you've chosen your gate basis in the right way. And so you can apply this without having to, I wrote this out over here so we don't have to write that all out in its full generality over here. We can just call this some function f, which takes an input of some index.
That's
some
multi-index.
It's some multi-index x, yes, which goes over every path and gives you a rational f. So since it's rational, we can compute the... F is going to be this, the Feynman decomposition for one path. Right, so that's some rational. So we can multiply that by a constant to make it an integer.
And you can compute that constant?
Right. This constant is just going to be the greatest common divisor of all those numbers. So it's going to be 2 to the poly n, and so log of that is going to be polynomial, and you can compute that efficiently. And we'll do this multiplication. So now you've got this. And so now we're going to find an indicator function g. To be... 1 if f of x is greater than y, and 0 otherwise. Right, so we define our indicator function, and so we let that be equal to a sum over the multi-index indicator. And so now what we have is a sum of binary values, sum of zeros and ones, of an exponential number of zeros and ones, which is something that can be computed efficiently.
Sorry, what is y running over?
Y is running over all...
do you want an integrator for y?
Yeah.
Or...
I'm also a little confused, too, because you said sum over f is equal to sum over c of that.
I could equivalently compute. You can equivalently compute. Yeah, that's not inequality there.
It's just that I could equivalently rescale things so that those rational numbers are now integers.
Exactly.
But you're assuming, maybe you said this, you're assuming mm-hmm. that the circuit involves unit arrays with only real coefficients?
Only rational coefficients. But,
no, but in particular, only real ones.
Well, at the end, we can just take the real part, or we can choose our gate bases appropriately so that we can just, so that we can use real coefficients.
No. Hold on. No. So, I mean, yeah, so... I mean, okay, so you can, it'll have, right, so in other words, the answer was yes. It's just real.
Yeah, sure. In other words, the answer is yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And y will be running over all possible values for f of x. So that's how we define our indicator.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Which could be positive or negative.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So now we, yeah, so we have defined this indicator function, which is...
You can also add a constant.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, so it could be positive or negative, and then we just have to add a constant offset to make it all positive if we want to.
So the goal of all this is, I understand why you're going through all this.
The goal of all this, again, kind of going back to what I was talking about here, is to convert this into a sum of zeros and ones, which can be computed using SharpP. And so that's sort of what I've done here, is transformed transform the computing of this trace into a function which is computable in SharpP. Sorry, quantum gravity guys will be done in a sec. So we've got this, which is computable in SharpP. It's a sum of zeros and ones. Now, we get this answer, and we can sort of undo what we've done so far, such that now we return to here. But since we know that we've bounded our false positives and negatives very tightly, we bound these to, say, be less than 1/4 each, then when we return, we're only within 1/4 on each side of our answer. So imagine that these are ints.
The answer must be integer.
Then the answer must, since the answer must be an integer, we know which integer we are.
Sorry, this is backing up, but it seems like an important question, actually.
Mm-hmm.
When you do the magnification,
mm-hmm.
So the acceptance and rejection probabilities are closer to 1,
mm-hmm.
at 1 and 0. Does that preserve this decomposition property? I forget what you called it now. Where you have just the good witnesses and the bad witnesses? That's not obvious to me. Because,
mm-hmm.
because I mean, the way you have a good witness is to repeat lots of times, and the way you mm-hmm. have a bad witness is, well, if they're all bad, then... No, but I mean, the point is, if you have, this is what I was getting at.
Okay.
So you repeat it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're doing the same protocol over and over again. And if you have one that starts with some goodness, that has some good witnesses and some bad witnesses, it seems like you could get witnesses that are kind of in between. Now, if it's a yes instance, you'll always have good witnesses that always accept a very high probability.
Right.
And if it's a no instance, you won't have those. But if it's mm-hmm. a yes instance, you also have, it seems to me, a lot of new things that will be in the intermediate.
That's a good point. I think. So I'm not sure that I can completely adequately answer your question right now,
yeah.
But I think that this isn't going to be a problem because of if you use a stronger amplification by Watchouse as opposed to a weak amplification.
Okay.
But I guess we can go over that a little bit later if you want. But yeah, I think if you use Watchouse's strong amplification, then it works.
Okay.
Yeah, so in an effort to kind of hurry things along, I'll say that there's a couple of open problems here. One being whether or not we can do this exact same or something similar.
Yeah, so that was the proof.
Right? Yeah, that was the proof.
We just concluded that.
Yeah, we just concluded the proof. There we go. Now we know we're done. So the big open problem here is that we had to introduce this sort of this class called SpecQMA in order to. Is that on this board? Yeah, we had to introduce this class called SpecQMA in order to do this. And the question is, can we do this using regular QMA? The problems in SpecQMA are obviously going to be interesting. There's still interesting problems there. So you're given a Hamiltonian, but you have to be promised that this local Hamiltonian has a gap, whereas in the original definition of QMA, that's not something that comes up. So we think that we can extend this to a regular QMA, but it's something we're still working on. And we're also trying to find complete problems for spec QMA in the case that doesn't work out. So, is any questions?
Sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I understood the premise of the problem, but I didn't want to interrupt.
Sorry.
About how you choose A and B, in what sense they depend on N?
In what sense they depend on...
A was a spectral gap.
I see. In what sense they depend on what?
Is A the spectral gap?
No, it's not.
The way I was imagining that was that if you are computing the density of states in a band, what is important is that this band has a gap with respect to the rest of the spectrum. But
exactly.
Now, A minus B seems to be the width of the band.
So yeah. No.
A minus B is, I mean, it's
is
not
the gap.
Exactly, but it's related to the distance between the bands.
Yes, exactly. It's related to the distance
is
between.
Like the width of the band.
Exactly. A, the difference between A is the width of the band.
From 0 to A.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, suppose you offset everything.
And then B to 1 is the width of everything else, kind of. I mean, those are probabilities rather than energy. So I guess you've written extensions.
Yeah, I've written extensions.
B to infinity.
Right.
Okay, yeah, I was just confused. I thought that A means...
Right. A minus B is a promise zero. Gap that there's... Yeah.
Yeah,
there's a difference between the bands.
So, yeah,
exactly.
So, yeah,
then,
some other questions? Okay, well, let's thank Breland for his great...